Good evening. I'd like to call a meeting of the Tompkins County Legislature for May 7th, 2013 to order. I'd like to call it to order. We're working on it. Could I have people join me in the Pledge of Allegiance, please? Roll call of members.
Mr. Stein?
Here.
Mr. Burbank?
I'm here.
Ms. Chalk?
I'm here.
Mr. Dennis is asked to be excused. Ms. Ferreira?
Here.
Ms. Kiefer? Here. Mr. Lane?
Here.
Ms. McAsey?
Present.
Mrs. McBean Claiborne?
Present.
Mr. McKenna?
Here.
Mr. Proto?
Here.
Ms. Pryor?
Here.
Mr. Robison?
Here.
Mr. Shinagawa?
Here.
Ms. Robertson?
Here.
14 members present.
Thank you. I have a couple of proclamations to hand out, including, I believe, one where somebody is here. Is there anyone here for Independent Living Week? All right, we're proclaiming. Which week? May 12th to 18th, 2013. It's Independent Living Week. And School Nurse Day. All right. Well, School Nurse Day is going to be May 8th, 2013. And One Day in Ithaca and Tompkins County, Alyssa Kogan, would you like to come on up? Whereas the City of Ithaca celebrated the 100th anniversary of its chartering as a city in 1988, and whereas the History Committee of the Ithaca Centennial Commission, as part of the city's year-long centennial celebration, determined it an appropriate time to tell future generations about what life was like in Ithaca and Tompkins County at the time of that celebration, and whereas to fulfill that aim, the Commission conducted the Great Ithaca Write-In on May 17, 1988, believed to be the first event of its kind in the United States, with close to 6,000 people responding to communicate the details of their lives, their thoughts, their values, and their hopes for the future. And whereas these materials were compiled in a community archive and excerpted in a book entitled One Day in Ithaca, published by the Centennial Commission, and whereas May 17, 2013, marks the 25th anniversary of the Great Ithaca Write-In, and is an appropriate time to reflect and again share our thoughts about our lives, our hopes, and our community. And whereas a small community committee led by Tompkins County historian Carol Kamen is coordinating this commemorative one-day write-in event on May 17th, inviting each citizen who lives here, works here, went to school here, or spent time here to write an account of his or her day, a memoir, a biography, or an explanation of his or her relationship with this community to be placed in the community archive. And whereas entries may be written and submitted at the write-in table at the Tompkins County Public Library on May 17th, mailed to the county historian at 125 East Court Street, Ithaca, New York, 14850, or submitted online at entry@onedayinithaca.com. Now, therefore, I, Martha Robertson, Chair of the Tompkins County Legislature, do hereby proclaim May 17th, 2013, as One Day in Ithaca and Tompkins County, and urge all citizens to participate in this important countywide community event. So, Alyssa? And Carol Kamen, would either of you like to say a few words?
For a long time, I thought One Day in Ithaca was all about creating community and an archive. But I also realized that One Day in Ithaca in Tompkins County is really about self-reflection, about who we are, where we are, and why we're here. And I hope you will all participate. In fact, I will check up and make sure you all do. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Carol. Thank you, Alyssa. Communications, petitions, proclamations, petitions, communications, and notices.
Communications are on the desks.
I would like to ask for an executive session at the end of the meeting to deal with personnel issues, but we wouldn't take action afterwards. So, I have Next item of business is privilege of the floor for the public. I have a few people signed up. We have a three-minute time limit. Diane Dawson, then Dami Harris. And Faye Gugakis. Diane.
I'll pass this along for the record. Good evening. I'm Diane Dawson, the Chief Executive Officer of the Tompkins County Senior Citizens Council, Incorporated, doing business as Lifelong. I appreciate your time this evening to allow us to speak briefly about our success and hopes for the future. The month of May is Older Americans Month, and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services theme for this month is Unleash the Power of Age. I cannot think of a more appropriate theme. The power that I witness day in and day out at Lifelong to create positive change in our community through volunteering and through programs which allow us to age well with health and dignity are nothing short of amazing. This is the difference that Lifelong has made in our county for over 60 years. Our track record is proven, and your support has been our primary source of encouragement and strength. Our seven primary programs at Lifelong are Lifelong Learning. Retired professors teach college-level courses during the fall and spring semesters, and there are no tests, which is great. Lifelong Activities. These programs range from fitness classes such as Enhanced Fitness, Tai Chi, yoga, dancing, and strength training offered at Lifelong and at McGraw House, St. Catharines, Titus Towers, and in Dryden, Lansing, Newfield, and Trumansburg. Also, we have a watercolor class, clay class, senior theater troupe, and senior chorus, among other programs. Retired Senior and Volunteer Program, RSVP, is part of the Senior Corps started by President Kennedy. Currently, over 400 RSVP volunteers serve over 50 not-for-profits in Tompkins County. Services include food pantries, blood drives, flu clinics, school and library service, gadabout, health insurance, and income tax counseling. RSVP has been part of Lifelong for 35 years. Northside Southside program serves the needs of our multicultural communities with close collaboration with GIAC and Southside Community Center, among others. Countywide, these programs include our travel program of local, domestic, and international travel, Ladies Senior Social Golf, Fort Warner Swim Program, coordination of community senior group officers meetings, local walks, etc. HICAP, Health Insurance Counseling and Assistance Program, the coordinator and eight volunteers work with COFA, the County Office for the Aging, to provide free Medicare counseling. Eight Lifelong volunteers certified by the New York State Office for the Aging gave 382 hours of service in 2012 to assist 353 clients. Tax counseling for the elderly. In 2013, 20 IRS-certified volunteers processed 719 federal and state income tax returns for free to help keep these resources in our local economy. We thank you for your county leadership and support. Please come to Lifelong's annual meeting at noon on May 16th at the Ramada Inn. We'll save a chair for you. We'll be grateful to have you there. Please confirm your reservation with us by Thursday, May 9th. Thank you for all you do.
Thank you very much, Diane. And I think the statement stopped somewhere.
Did it not get passed down?
Just as long as we make sure it's okay if you look at it, but just keep sending it down. Dami Harris and then Faye Gugakis.
I am from Women's Opportunity Center. I have worked there almost now 30 years. And we have helped over 15,000 women over the past 34 years. And more than one-third of them found jobs. What our center does is help women under poverty to become job-ready by going through individual counseling and giving them all the necessary things for them to be successful at workplace. And we can't do a group training or anything like this for these women. They have different stories of their lives, and they are at different stages. The only way we can successfully help them is treating them individually, career counseling and training. And most of them, I mean, honestly, I never expected that kind of poverty in this country. They can't afford to buy underwear. I mean, I'm sorry, I know there are some men, but I am not shy to say that. But most of the women do not use sanitary napkins. They use tissue papers. I mean, people don't think it that way. It's so expensive for women to buy those because food stamp won't cover it. There's no other way to buy it. I realized that when we were losing our toilet tissue rolls and in our office and found out that that's what they use. There are quite a number of women. So we started finding money, scholarship money, and now giving for sanitary napkins and for all the deodorant and everything, because it's very hard to go to a job when you don't smell nice. You and I, all of you, have favorite shampoo. You take a bath in the morning and spray something and get ready and don't think about it twice. Am I going to wear underwear today or not? But all these issues are keeping these women finding jobs and getting out of the house. It's unbelievable poverty there. And we help one at a time and getting them. They don't have a way of coming to our office even. They don't have bus passes. They can't afford a bus pass. So we try to, I have a non-traditional scholarship fund we started a while ago, and we give them bus passes and gas cards and make sure they come. And we have computer training and other training. Our retail boutique, a while ago, the county supported it. Now it's self-sufficient. And it helped over 150 women to train, do retail training, and build their self-confidence. If you look at a woman who come to our center looking down and don't look at your face, and when they go out after training and getting a job, jumping up and down, that's what kept me 30 years there. I mean, it's unbelievable. We, Department of Labor, calculated the return for our dollar. It's $1 to $17 we put back to the community. Oof. I mean, where is that kind of investment you can find? It is really an amazing program. And if you talk to women, they have so many stories that they come with. A lot of women come with broken teeth, broken faces, but their heart get mended after they go through the training and they find jobs and they are able to support. The other thing that our program does that we don't realize is eliminating the generational poverty cycle.
Finish up, Tommy.
I don't know whether you know about the generational poverty cycle. If the mother and the family know nobody worked, the children never learn the work ethics and just the normal ABC things that we learn day to day from our parents. And I have talked to some children who come. Their dream job is cleaning woman. I mean, when you ask your children, what is your dream job? Maybe politician. My daughters always wanted to be a lawyer. That's all they knew when I was a lawyer in Sri Lanka. So that's how the children learn from your parents. And if they don't know to dream bigger.
Thank you, Dami. That's 3 minutes.
The time. Right. So I know that you all have supported us long, and I know most of you all know our program. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And please visit our center, visit the boutique, and talk to me if you have any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Gakas.
Good evening. I actually know Dami for 30 years, and she does a fantastic job. So thank you, Dami. I have an announcement first. On May 11th, which is this Saturday, at the St. Catherine's Greek Orthodox Church, corner of Seneca and Geneva Street, there will be an event called Taste of Greece from 10 to 8, and there's going to be a lot of good food, and we're welcoming the community and hope you can come. I'm going to just say something brief that I saw last night before I go into the reason why I'm here. Last night I was watching, I believe it was the News Hour, and they were talking about hydrofracking, since that's going to be discussed tonight, in Poland. So another area of the world that is being hydrofracking is happening, and they talked about government was shown saying how safe it was, and then they showed farmers and people being concerned that, you know, the water is going to be ruined and the air is going to be ruined. So this is also happening in so many other parts of the world. But I came here tonight to share with you something else that I saw recently on the news, and that was last Friday. It was on NBC News, which was also aired on Rock Central Friday night. It's another program like 60 Minutes. And it it was Ann Curry, who is a journalist for NBC News, and it was incredible that NBC News did carry such a story. You're going to say, why am I talking about this story? Because it relates to us, because that oil is going to come back to us to use in the U.S. So when we talk about hydrofracking, we also need to be mindful of other oils or other energy that we're using around the world that's coming back to the U.S. And in this case, I miss Hinchey very much, our Congressman Hinchey, because what Hinchey did is he heard so many different issues, and I miss him right now. So this news report was on Ecuador. In Ecuador, we have huge forest area, Amazonian forest area.
1 minute.
And the government in Ecuador wants to deforest 8 million acres, which will destroy the lives of two tribes, the Chichua and the Wanami. It is the rainforest, as you know, a huge diversity. It's immoral. It's immoral for that oil to come here, okay, especially when we're fighting against hydrofracking. We need to be mindful of what we do in the U.S. to other parts of the world. I came here because I'm very upset about this. I saw the faces of the people that are being affected. They're pleading. This is their land, passed generation to generation, just like the native people in the land that we're standing on now. Okay, I urge you to Google it, to find out more about the story. Go to the NBC website and see that segment, because this is about to happen. And we could stop it, actually, because that oil is coming here. And
please,
we, as the U.S., can stop it. And one thing I want to share is they're trying to match money to money to save a portion of that area. And the one country that is not doing that and sending money to save that smaller portion, which is not going to be as helpful because you want to save that whole area, is the U.S. So that was very telling in the segment.
Thank you, Faye.
I really urge you to watch this, because it's important, and it's also so damning for us to allow this to happen. And I think we can stop it.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you. Are there any other members of the public? Municipal official, Dan Klein? All right. Legislative privilege of the floor. Anyone? Frank.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of things I just wanted to bring to your attention. First, I know that we have one more meeting this month before we have to become even more aware, but the Memorial Day is at the end of this month, and you will be invited, as you always are, to participate in the parade. So if you just stay tuned, that's coming together now. Second item, I put on each of your desks a brochure that looks like this. The reason I wanted to bring this up is as we are taking up the issue of job creation and keeping people, especially young people, in the community and finding employment, you may not, I became aware that even though we did a meeting wizard on this, some of you, for one reason or another, may not have received it. Some of us have been working with BOCES to have an opportunity to meet with the staff up there and have a tour of the facility and see what they're doing in job creation for high school students. And the second phase, hopefully, will be to revive the adult training piece that they're doing. In an effort to expose you to that, pardon me, we put together a luncheon for this Thursday that is going to be put on by the students in their culinary arts program. And some of these kids get placed in local restaurants and whatnot. So in case you didn't get the meeting wizard, it's this Thursday at noon at BOCES. We're meeting in the Powell building. It's the building on your immediate right as you drive in off Warren Road. We're trying to get a head count. Right now it looks like five or six of us are able to make it, And if you'd like to come, we'd love to have you. Third, third item and last. Consumer Minute, okay? The Universal Fund. When you get home tonight, if you have a landline, check your telephone bill. I have, my home is served by Frontier Communications, and in the bill I received last week, there's a paragraph that I'd like to read you in the customer information section. And I'll do this quickly. Beginning this month, a new New York Universal Service Fund surcharge will appear on your monthly bill. The rate is so much per access line. The surcharge, as approved by New York's Public Service Commission, will help provide, and it goes on to describe the same major categories that the FCC's Universal Fund services. Well, I did a double take on this because I don't remember reading anything about New York State starting one of these, and I certainly don't remember any public, maybe some of you do, any public notice that the Public Service Commission held a hearing on anything which they're supposed to do on something like this. So we did a quick snoop and couldn't find anything. So I just wanted to alert you that we shot a letter off to our state legislators asking if they knew anything about this. How do you apply for it? When was it started? Because here we go again. Our locals, all of us, will be paying another indirect tax, and we don't know anything about this one. Have any of the rest of you perhaps heard about this? Now, I have Frontier, but I believe that because they're able to charge this on any phone bill, that it would be appropriate to check whatever service your home line is served by.
Frank, I seem to remember that there were a number of fees added or increased in the state budget.
Yeah,
maybe that's
the,
one of them.
The increase was for the New York Universal Service surcharge. They raised, and I didn't want to get into this, but might as well since you brought it up, the carrier cost recovery surcharge was raised, and the tax that New York is able to pass on, the gross receipts surcharge, all these are surcharges, was raised. Maybe those are the ones you're referring to, Martha. But, yeah, you're absolutely right. So right now, 20% of my phone bill are taxes and fees. I hope you are treated to a more favorable treatment than that. And when I called Frontier to get an explanation, of course, the customer service person didn't know what I was talking about.
Thank you, Frank. Carol and then Will.
Later tonight, we have a resolution on our agenda related to hydrofracking and trying to encourage the to New York State to pass either a ban or a moratorium, and in addition to push the DEC to start the process over again. Regardless of what happens with that later tonight, the Citizens Campaign for the Environment is having a lobby day related to the bill, in particular the moratorium bills, on May 22nd. It's not a huge, they're not looking for thousands to come out to a rally. They're looking for, I don't know, about 100 people to come and be dispersed to lobby. They'll help set up the appointments. And they in particular appealed to us if any legislators, they would love to have legislators, particularly from bodies that have passed these resolutions, to come and help them with the lobbying. That's on May 22nd. If you are interested, you can ask me about it, or you can go to citizenscampaign.org. They will take other people as well. You don't have to be a government official to participate, but please, if there's anybody from here, I don't know if I can go, but if any of you are willing to go, citizenscampaign.org. and then looked for fracking action day with hyphens between it, fracking hyphen action hyphen day. And there'll be a briefing from 9:30 to 10:30 and lobby visits between 11 to 3, and you'd be doing it in the company of other people.
Carol, could you put that together in an email and maybe send all of us, you know, to...
Sure.
Okay, thank you. Will?
Thank you. So we get lots of invitations to all kinds of things, and it's hard to keep up with them. I want to give quick reports on three things that I went to in the past week that I think everybody got invitations to, but I happened to be go. The first was from this group that is responsible for pipeline safety. And they did an event up at the Ramada Inn last week and sort of gave an introduction to what we need to know about all the pipes that are going through our county. I'm not on Public Safety Committee, and maybe others are already aware, but I found it very informative. I had already known that if you're going to dig or excavate, that you can call this number, 811, and they'll come out and they will map where the various gas lines and water lines and everything on your property are. It's a free service, and it's very quick. It's painless. What I had not realized is that this doesn't even have to be a big excavation project. It could be something as benign, seemingly, as a garden post or something like that. If you're going down anywhere where you suspect there might, in fact, be pipes, call that number. One of the things that they showed at this presentation was what happens if you don't, and it can be quite frightening. So that was one thing. Number one. The second thing that I went to was happenstance. I stopped by for my mail and discovered something happening out in our lobby. They had all these cookies and just a nice sort of reception thing. I said, "What is this?" Well, what it was the naturalization ceremony for people becoming American citizens. Happens about three times a year, and I decided to sit on in it, and it was literally amazing. We do a wonderful job. I mean, they really, really put on a very, very nice program. There were about 35 people from 20 different countries. Aurora did a wonderful job of getting people's names reasonably right, I think. But they had just a beautifully presented flowers and flags, and they had a youth group. The Ithaca Talent Association had a string section that did American the Beautiful. It literally brought tears to my eyes, and it was just so delightful to sit on this and then know that we here in Thomas County are doing a good job, I think, of welcoming people. And the Kiwanis has a very nice little reception afterwards. If you ever see one of these, I encourage you to go. It's quite inspiring. The last thing was something that was the second time we've done it. This is the Streets Alive event that happened this last Sunday. And it was basically where they close a street in downtown Ithaca for about 3-4 hours and encourage people to come down and walk, bike, roller skate, whatever. And it was a nice day on Sunday, but the output, the response from the community was amazing. I mean, there was music, there was bicycle repair clinics, there was food and everything, but mostly it was just random interactions with people I hadn't seen all winter. You didn't know who you're going to run into, but they were there. And once again, it's a great event. Our tourist dollars are going into it. They're going to try to have these happen more frequently. So next time it comes around, think about going to Streets Alive. And that's it.
Thank you very much, Will. Carol had
I had a reaction to what to something that Will just said. I have this vague memory from my first year here of maybe getting invited to one of the naturalization ceremonies and on a date that I couldn't go. And I don't know whether it was connected to the legislature, being in the legislature or not, but I think it would be a very nice thing for us to request to get advance notice of those. I think they happen several times a year. And maybe trying to make sure that we have somebody there just to let the new citizens know that we welcome them. if that's something that would be the will of the legislature.
Sure. The ceremony is Aurora's, you know, right. Up to Aurora, and so she does welcome people on behalf of the county as the county clerk. But I'll send her a note and say, just let us know when those are coming. I agree. Peter?
Yeah, I was just going to ask a shortened version of what Carol said. Do you happen to know when the next naturalization is, Will?
I know, Peter. I know it happens 3 times a year. So
you know who you ask? Who
Aurora will know. Aurora.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mike?
Well, our dysfunctional state legislature is living up to its appellation. It was another week of shame when a senator was arrested and accused of embezzlement. I don't know whether he's guilty or not. That'll wait to be seen, but it certainly is the kind of thing that doesn't make New Yorkers very proud of what we have for a state government. Some things have happened. They've touted budgets that have been adopted on time, of course, leaving all the hard things until later. But it's still not working very well. It's gone from 3 men in a room to 4 men in a room now, making all the decisions out of the public eye. The only ones knowing about them, those decisions, really are the lobbyists that stalk the halls of the state legislature, much closer to those legislators than any of us in the districts are. We need change. We need to keep thinking about this. And it's only 4 years until we get to vote again on having a constitutional convention. I hope the people will take that opportunity to vote for that.
Thank you, Mike. Brian.
Thanks. I wanted to thank Mike, actually, for it was last Thursday. He set up another joint meeting between ourselves here at this legislature in Cortland. I find them to be very helpful, if for no other reason. I live quite close to Cortland County, do spend a fair amount of time over there, and it's nice to know what's going on over there. I can tell you that every time, and I've tried to make them all, every time I go, it kind of makes you feel better, you know.
Misery loves company.
Yeah, a little bit. And in a lot of ways, we how do I say this? We might be a little further ahead of things. So I think it's very helpful for them, but it's also helpful for us. If for no other reason, we certainly have common difficulties. Especially when it relates to state government and that sort of thing. It's just a really nice thing to have, and I'm glad you do it. And there was not cookies there. We actually had food, like real food, but we had to pay for it too.
Separate
checks, yeah. But I really do appreciate those meetings.
Thank
you, Brian. Sure.
Yes, and the thought was to see perhaps next time if we could maybe do an evening meeting, maybe a dinner or something like that, and try to get some of the folks that aren't able to come at noontime.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mike.
Good idea.
Off of that.
Pam?
Well, I was just wondering if you had anything more specific that you talked about, or if you identified some mutual concerns or issues that you thought we might be working together, like a new joint Sheriff's Department or something?
Go ahead, Mike. Brian?
We spoke a lot about TC3 and where we're going to be, whether we're going to be able to help TC3 more with its budget this year. And Cortland wanted to think more about it and talk with their people. They're still crowding their constitutional tax limit over there. So they're worried about that, and whatever we do, we pay 63% of the cash to TC3, and they pay 37% of it, so we need to coordinate that. But we'll be having the budget luncheon and presentation of the TC3 budget next week, and or is it this week? Next week.
This week.
This week. Sorry, this Friday, and so hopefully we were a little bit prepped. Other things we just kind of went around the table. It was very interesting, and people, different legislators from both counties, brought up things. They're having a lot of trouble with their jail and the board outs over there. They're still concerned about the high costs of operating their landfill and the small amount of trash that's coming into it. I think they told us over there that they're putting more cover on it than they are putting trash into it, which is very wasteful of the landfills that they paid $9 million to build. Brian, what else did they talk about?
You remember? I think, and Joe, you can help us out with this. They're very interested in going from an elected treasurer to more along the lines of what we have in terms of a chief financial officer in the way we do it. So, you know, there was some stuff there. Yes, they did talk about their jail situation, which in a lot of ways isn't a whole lot different than ours, and that will be an item maybe we can discuss further later as kind of a joint venture. I know that was something that was talked about jointly a number of years ago, and maybe time to dust that off and think about it again. We spoke about different types of consolidation or sharing of services and some of the pluses and minuses that go with those sorts of things. I really can't think of everything, but it's it really would be something that if we could get this evening arrangement where, because quite frankly we have five or six and they have five or six, and it's hard to speak for the rest of the group because it's not a representative group, but if we could get that sort of forum, I think it'd be good.
So. All right, I have a few people's hands went up in response to this. I'm going to ask if we have guests here. We have actually a very long agenda. Perhaps we can have a more general discussion about this, say, after, under, we can pick a committee it would go under and kind of do that later as a discussion topic under a committee agenda. If you have other privilege of the floor things, I'd like to have those, but honestly, I'm looking at the clock and we have people here. I've got Leslin, Frank, and Dooley, so with that, you know, it's up to you, but I'm hoping we can have a more general discussion about this later in the meeting. Leslin?
Thank you very much. I need to get on my soapbox for a minute, and it doesn't have anything to do with the joint legislature meeting. You know, the weather is getting nicer, and people are out in the streets. Thank you, Will, for speaking of Streets Alive. One of our supervisors at GIJ was happy to be a participant in helping to organize Streets Alive that extended along Court Street in front of GIAC, and we had the dancing part. We were dancing in the streets. But it brought up for me just sort of a reminder to everyone out there. It's nice to see people out, you know, just random people getting to know each other, that even in our neighborhoods, to do the same just to get to know who's in your neighborhood. Our law enforcement community has had their hands full with some of the crime that's been happening in our community, violence, crime. As it gets nicer, people go crazy. Faye is always telling us about these drivers, and I'm watching people just driving erratically in our streets. And just to take time, and I know everybody's been cooped up for the winter, and they just want to get out, but just get to know who's in your neighborhood, who lives around you, so that when you see strange faces, you know who's there. In the event that things happen, we need to help our law enforcement as well, and to just be mindful that yes, there are people out in the streets, so be careful with how you are using that your vehicle, which can be a very dangerous weapon. So I wanted to just get on my soapbox for a minute and share that and thank the folks who organize Streets Alive, because it's one of the, it doesn't have to be an organized celebration like that for people to just get to know who is around you. It's very important. Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie. Frank?
Thanks, Martha. Mike, I would like to add my thanks, too, if you could organize perhaps the next one in the evening. That would be very helpful. The question I had was related to topics.
Then let's have that conversation later, Frank. I really mean it. I think we can do this later.
The topic I was wondering is, did the consolidated bus service, was there any discussion about that? Just yes or no. Thank you.
Dooley?
My comment is totally about the Cortland meeting.
All right.
And for people with long memories, I inquired about how their OTB office was going. They used to bring in $250,000, and they now get, I don't know, several tens of thousands of dollars. It's way, way down. I thought it was important to let Frank know that.
All right. Anyone else? Thank you all. Now I'd like to bring up Ed and Bob and Tony. We have a rare privilege of having Bob Howarth and Tony Ingraffi here in Tompkins County in the same evening, and both here. We've had, I personally know that their travel schedules are pretty significant. Ed, do you want to bring the microphone down?
Can I sit over there?
Sure, of course, yeah. Okay.
I was just going to speak from here, and Ed's going to work the computer.
Okay, great.
Tony's going to answer the questions after I botch it up, if that's okay.
All right.
Tony and I are very pleased to be here tonight. We're going to talk briefly about this paper that we were part of, which came out about 6 weeks or so ago now.
Bob, would you first introduce yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Bob Howarth. I'm the David R. Atkinson Professor of Ecology and Environmental Biology at Cornell. I've been the faculty there since 1985, a proud member of the community. Professor Ingraffia there is the Dwight C. Baum Professor of Engineering at Cornell. And Tony and I have been working together for 3.5-4 years on hydrofracking sort of issues. We started about 2 years ago also working on this, trying to come up with an alternative. Let me give you just a slight background of where I'm coming from, and then I'll get into the plan. I've worked on climate change for a long, long time. My first job after I got my PhD in 1979 was to lead an institutional course, I believe the first one in the United States, a graduate course on climate change. And I've continued to work on that since. I've worked on things like oil pollution. I was the chief consultant for the state of Alaska for the Exxon Valdez oil spill. So I've spent 40 years working on what's wrong with fossil fuels across the board and how we can maybe do better. It's frustrating. I've looked for a long time towards what we could do better. I lived off the grid for 2 years. That was a little tough. I was young. I now have an electric car. There are things we can do. But I was very attracted to the work of Mark Jacobson at Stanford, who started publishing about 3 to 4 years ago, saying that we could make the world free of fossil fuels in an unbelievably short period of time, within the next 25 to 30 years. And at first I'm saying, wow, that's incredible, you know. But like most of you, you're probably skeptical. You go, well, that's not possible, right? So I tried to read his technical papers, and I go, well, you know, there's a lot of detail here. It looks right. Mark Jacobson was here 2 years ago, 25 months ago, exactly. Tony and I and others ate lunch with him, and we convinced Mark to think of New York as a model of how to make his relatively abstract thinking work at a real place. No one had ever come up with a concrete plan for making a geographic area free of fossil fuels on a real-time basis. So Mark is the intellectual force behind what I'm going to be telling you here. We published a paper, a peer-reviewed journal, 6 weeks ago. It's gotten a huge amount of attention. This is the 8th talk I've given on it. I was invited to the United Nations, where I got incredible reception, huge amount of interest there. I was invited to talk to union groups. I got the head of the guy who runs the coal-burning power plants for the state, you know, the union guy behind that. He goes, my members are going to like this. I'm saying, really? Anyway, let me give you the plan. Next slide, please. We chose why New York State? Well, the bottom there is the first thing. We wanted a clear choice between this ridiculous idea of shale gas as a bridge fuel, which I don't think it is, Tony doesn't think it is, the science doesn't point to it. Is there another choice for New York for energy? That was our driving thing. But beyond that, New York, if you take apart the economy of the United States, we are the eighth largest economy in the world. We are significant in our greenhouse gas emissions. We're significant as a place on the surface of the planet. They're in the middle. New York City is the most energy efficient city in the United States by a factor of 3 or 4. So we already have a head start. There's no other city like it. It's very European in character, very energy dense. That's a great start. And, of course, we have a lot of rural environments. We have a lot of other things going with us. So let's make New York a model for how to move into the 21st century. That was our goal. Next slide, please. This, to me, is the background. See, I've worked on climate change for a long, long time. This work came out of the NASA Goddard Space Institute last year. Drew Schindel and others put it out. And the take-home message, I won't bore you with the detail, except that what this says, these are the best models available for how climate change is going. What they say is that we are in trouble as a planet if we don't control methane emissions. Because of climate lags in carbon dioxide, the climate will warm into those yellow ranges, dangerously warm temperatures where we have a real possibility of runaway global warming. And it'll do so in the time period of 16 to 17 years from now, at the low end, up to 35 years from now, unless we control methane. Climate is more responsive to methane than anything else, and fracking is a disaster for methane. Natural gas is a disaster for methane. So we do not want natural gas, and we want to suggest a positive alternative. That was part of our plan. Next slide. That's Tony's and my work on it. Shale gas is bad. You probably know we think that. We can talk more about it later. Next slide. The other part of the plan is that fossil fuels are bad for health. This shows the New York City area and fine particles. There are a lot of deaths and a lot of economic damage, $33 billion a year to the state of New York from air pollution, health costs from fossil fuels. So that's something that by getting rid of fossil fuels, we can make a big difference of. Here in New York, state, there are 4,000 premature deaths a year from fossil fuels. Here in Tompkins County, our study says there are 12 deaths per year. That's a non-trivial part. Next slide. Okay, so what's the plan? Again, Mark Jacobson of Stanford is an engineer. He's the real intellectual power behind this, quite frankly. He and his students, but the rest of us contributed some, and we got him to do it for New York. This is the first geographically specific plan to take any place on the planet away from fossil fuels. I want to reiterate that. The United Nations has picked it up as a model. So, to start, you electrify transportation, get rid of fossil fuels in cars. You get rid of fossil fuels for hot water heating and for domestic heating. And when you do so, and you use the modern technologies that are available now, which were not available 5 years ago, I want to highlight that, then you have a huge increase in the efficiency and you use less energy overall. So even with doing nothing like sound planning and all, which we should, you get a 37% reduction in overall energy use to live the same way by electrifying these things. We chose the most environmentally benign technologies. It's mostly wind, but there are other things in there. Critically, we relied on technologies that are commercially available today. We're not dreaming about what might be possible in 5 years or 10 years or 30 years. It's what's commercially available today. Now, will technologies get better and bring down costs? Absolutely. But we don't have to wait. Would this have been possible half a dozen years ago? No, because a lot of the key technologies were not available 6 years ago. But they are now, and we can do it now. And New York can take a lead on that. Energy storage is critical to it, and I can go into the detail of that. I probably won't unless you're really interested. Hydrogen generation is important to that, and we have a very antiquated way to generate hydrogen from electrolysis of the sort that's been done commercially in this country for 120 years. But that generates a storage ability, and it also provides an energy source that you can use for making steel. You can fly jet airplanes with it. You can use it for long-distance trucks. Next slide. Other ways to deal with storage issues, I really won't go into that unless you want to talk to me later, because I don't want to waste your time. I just want to point out that we've thought about it. Hydrogen is a key part of it, and one other aspect is to interconnect wind, because if it's windy on Long Island, it may not be in Buffalo and vice versa, But you don't have to store energy to make each wind turbine energy self-sufficient. If you interconnect them, you don't need anywhere near as much storage, and that's an important part of the plan. Next slide. Okay, the plan is cost-effective. The price tag is $570 billion, which we've paid out over about 25 years. We currently are paying $33 billion in health costs in this state from fossil fuel use. So in 17 years, the health cost savings would pay for the entire conversion, let alone any aspect of this plan. This is affordable. Creates a huge number of jobs. I'll give you a little bit of statistics on that in a minute. Critically, it stabilizes energy prices. We have some of the highest energy prices in the country, in the world here. This would stabilize them, and I think that would be great for energy and commerce. And it hugely decreases air pollution. Next slide. These are our cost estimates of the technologies that we're using. On the middle column there is the cost in cents per kilowatt hour delivered electricity as of a few years ago. Wind power is already cost competitive with new natural gas production or with current coal production, so these are already cost effective. Some of them aren't quite cost competitive yet, unless you can include the external costs of things like health costs, in which case every single thing we're doing is now cost competitive. And of course, the price of fossil fuels is going to go up, and the price of renewables is going to go down. There's no doubt about that. You can quibble with our numbers, but we project that within the next decade or so, all of these things will be far more cost competitive than fossil energy. And if New York gets a head start on it, that would be incredible for our economy, right? Next slide. Jobs, just quickly on jobs. If you look nationwide in the United States, there are 3.7 jobs per $1 million spent in energy production and fossil fuels, about three times on average for renewable energy. That's the national average. Fossil fuels are very capital-intensive, job-poor approach. Next slide. Specifics of the plan for New York. During the construction phase, which is about 20 years, it'd be equivalent of about 220,000 job full-time equivalents. Now, those are different people, different things moving around over 20 years, but the equivalent of almost 250,000 full-time jobs over that 20-year period. Long-term, 76,000 jobs out of this. That's a lot more than are employed in the fossil fuel industry at the moment. And we did not include things like weatherization of homes and things like that that ought to be part of that. Installing heat pumps like that one in the lower right that's in my basement at the moment, which I paid someone $2,000 to install, so it's good jobs to be made doing things like that. Next slide. And again, by having hydrogen as an energy store, I gave a talk in Buffalo a few weeks ago, and I made the point that, you know, you can reinvigorate the steel industry of Buffalo around hydrogen and clean steel. What a novel idea, you know. Manufacturing jobs in New York that are clean environmentally. Next slide. A plan called for no use of liquid biofuels. I chaired the International Council of Sciences review of biofuels several years ago. We recommended strongly to the United Nations and all the nations of the world not to go with liquid biofuels for a variety of environmental reasons. Mark Jacobson also has done research in biofuels and shares my feeling, and our plan says solidly no. We do see a role for solid biomass in a limited way, pellet stoves in homes, things like that. Next
slide. I'm sorry, Bob, do you mean biofuel, you mean ethanol?
Yes.
For example.
Yes, ethanol and biodiesel, but particularly ethanol. Terrible fuel. I'm happy to explain why. Very strong no to natural gas and shale gas in particular. Why? Because of the greenhouse gas footprint of methane. But in addition to that, and I think this is critically important and missed by much of society, shale gas is not like conventional gas. The wells fall off incredibly quickly in their production. If you want a sustained supply of gas, you've got to be out there redrilling, refracking every 16 months or so, and you're dependent on stable prices and stable industry to do that. If you don't have that, that is not a secure energy source. It just isn't. Bad idea for the state. Next slide. We don't like clean coal with carbon capture. There are a variety of reasons why. Basically, the renewable energies are cheaper. Coal mining is inherently bad anyway. And at the bottom point down there, the whole idea of carbon capture captures the mind of politicians looking for win-win solutions, but it's unproven. And the tests where people have tried it so far, it's not working very well. It leaks. It's corrosive. It's nasty. Next slide. Nuclear power, we don't like nuclear power. Nuclear waste disposal remains an issue. It's not cost competitive with the renewables we have. And when I talked with the United Nations, they love the idea that I pointed out that it's bad for nuclear proliferation as well. Next slide. So that's it. Our paper's out there in the peer-reviewed literature. Mark Jacobson and his students truly are the real intellectual force, but Tony and I helped give it a New York flavor. I think it's a critically important thing for New York to do. We've gotten some interest in the governor's office, and I can really imagine this county taking leadership and making it happen. So I'm delighted to be here talking to you tonight. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Bob. Tony, do you want to add anything before we take questions?
Answer questions if you have any.
Okay, terrific. Well, I'll ask you to go to the mic also. Thank you very, very much, both of you. Any questions out there before I throw mine in? Carol?
Well, the biggest question is there a time and a place that we could hear you give the longer version of this talk, really explaining each of the slides?
Do you want it tonight?
I wish we could.
No, we don't have anything scheduled, but that's a good point. We should give something, and Tony and I can probably do a pretty good job of that. What we really should do is get Mark Jacobson in here, too. But we can go through a fair amount of detail on any of this.
Okay.
Three of the authors, Mark Jacobson, the principal author, Jeanette Barth, whose name is on there, she's an economist, and I are giving the long version of this in Mount Kisco next Tuesday night, for those of you who want to come.
Mount Kisco.
Thank you. Okay, I got Dooley, Frank. Dooley, Frank, Pam, Nathan.
Well, I would love to know more about stored concentrated solar power. You said you didn't really plan to get into that. I am curious about the status of hydrogen fuel cells because they still seem to be needing a lot of work. But my question to you is, recently I saw a very short news item that said EPA, I think it was, has put out a report saying their estimates of leakage from gas pipelines is lower than one has thought. And I have no idea what your reaction to that is or whether it matters very much.
Yeah, I'll let Tony answer that one in a minute.
Yeah, go ahead.
Tony and I were together earlier this afternoon comparing notes, and I think we've each had, I don't know, 500 questions about that in the last 3 weeks. Either of us could answer, but I'll let Tony give his answer. I think we're in agreement. On the hydrogen fuel cell, hydrogen fuel cells are not a big part of our plan because they are not commercially available in a reliable way at the moment. There are ways that people tell us they're out there on the horizon for generating hydrogen more efficiently by electrolysis. We didn't count on that. Our economics is on this antiquated process that has been done at Niagara Falls since the late 19th century. You know, we're using proven technologies. You one other part of the question on
the concentrated
solar thing, and then I'll Tony talk to the EPA. We call, I think, for 10% of the power from concentrated solar, and that's basically mirrors and things to concentrate heat, superheat water. You can store the water, and that allows you to generate the electricity through conventional turbine processes, very much like in a coal burning or gas burning plant, on demand as you need electricity. So it's a storage technique. It works best in places like Arizona where they have more heat, but it works here. It has been commercially tried. It is used. And that was the one that the union guy who works for the coal burning plant really liked. He goes, I can see my membership doing that. And one other thing, let me just, before I let Tony answer the EPA issue, the other thing the union guy said across the board, the average member, we're the most unionized state in the country, but the average age of a union member in this country is 54. And these guys are saying, man, this plan we can see as a way to get youthful 20-year-olds into the unions. People would be excited about being part of a society where they can do stuff like this, and they want to train that workforce. They want to be part of it. I thought these guys would be critical. They loved it. They endorsed it. So I'm very optimistic. The technologies are there. The politics is the hard part. But if the unions are on board and the economics make sense, which I think they do, I'm optimistic. Tony, on the EPA?
On the EPA issue, are we off the record?
Oh, yeah, well, except that you're on television. But
okay.
Other than that.
I'll stick to the science and stay out of the politics. You can imagine the political pressure that the EPA has on it right now to try to follow the all-the-above energy policy of the Obama administration. So I'll stay away from that other than to say that they're under tremendous pressure. So about 10 days ago, EPA announced that it was going to reduce two emission factors associated with the entire life cycle of the production, storage, processing, transportation, and end use of methane. That's what we mean by the life cycle, from the time it comes out of the ground to the time it gets to the burner tip. They decided to reduce, after increasing them 2 years ago, for the first time in 14 years, they decided to reduce two of them. And the reason they did is because they were given data by one gas operator operating in one play, the Barnett, Texas, saying that they had EPA had overestimated those emission factors. And that the EPA claimed that the new data was confirmed by the Texas Railroad Commission. There's supposed to be laughter at this point, but I didn't get any. Okay, still on the science. Literally a day later, the EPA also announced, and not many people have picked up on this, that they are proposing to increase what's called a global warming potential for methane from its current Code of Federal Regulations legal number of 21 to a new number, higher, 25. The global warming potential quite simply is the ratio of the amount of heating that methane creates in the atmosphere compared to carbon dioxide. The higher the number, the worse you are. So methane, according to federal law, currently is 21 times more potent as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. EPA is proposing to increase that number to 25. Well, that's a 19% increase. And when you run the numbers, it turns out that the EPA giveth and the EPA taketh away. So they reduce their emission factors for 2 years of production while in the background saying that they've always been wrong by 19% in terms of what the impact on climate of methane has been. They also have not yet adjusted to the fact, pointed out by the graph that Bob showed here two times, that we don't have 100 years to work the climate change problem. And that number 21, or the new proposed number 25, assumes that we have 100 years to work the problem. If we only have 20 or 25 years to work the problem, those numbers aren't 21 or 25. They're more like 100. So this slight decrease in a few emission factors is more than compensated for by the fact that the effect on climate change of methane has been underestimated forever by EPA.
So
that's a long answer to a very simple question.
They're still using the 100-year time scale.
They're still using 100-year time scale.
Okay.
Just for context, the 21 factor was based out of the IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, report from 1997. The 2007 report, which is two reports later, said 25 for 100 years. It said 72 for the 20-year time period. More recent science says it ought to be 33 for the 20-year period, and there ought to be 105 for the 20-year period. And by the way, we should be using the 20-year period because that's the critical time to get methane under control. So the next report from the IPCC, which will be coming out next year, I'll give you 100-to-1 odds, will say you ought to be using 105. But in the meanwhile, EPA's taken this decades-old step to take it from 21 to 25. They're greatly underestimating the problem.
This is key, and this group has heard me yammer about this topic a few times. Is that, you said the EPA has just made that change. Tony, you once told me this is set in law?
Yes, Code of Federal Regulations.
So the EPA has just changed that? Is that
they're proposing to change it.
They're proposing to change it. Yes. And NYSERDA's calculations of everything about energy use also uses the same. Everybody in the country has to use that same
21.
Number. 21, okay.
And in fact, everyone internationally uses it because by international convention, the U.S. EPA sets the guidelines internationally. So despite the fact that the most recent science for a long time has been saying something else, the globe has been using this outdated science.
Okay.
Thank you for the rest of the story.
Sure. All right, thank you very much. I got Frank, Pam, Nathan, Peter, and then Will.
Thanks for... there's a lot of food for thought here, a lot. First question, is this available, is the long presentation available online or somewhere?
The paper is available online. I don't think any of us have been taped yet giving a longer presentation, as far as I know. I haven't. I've only been taped giving shorter ones.
Well, it's now on. It'll be available on our legislature's website.
But that's the short one. But that's the short version.
The paper's available. You can go to Mark Jacobson's website. You can go to mine. You can go to Physician Scientists and Engineers. Tony's president of it's publicly available for free.
Can you get? Excuse me, Carol. Can you get the office the contact information?
Sure.
The question that I have for you, and Tony, you said you wanted to stay away from politics, but you may not want to tackle this. With the governor promoting converting all these electric generating facilities away from coal but for natural gas, you got with the plan that you've talked about, maybe natural gas is not the way to go. Would you care to comment on anything, respecting the fact that it's a little political?
Let me take a stab at that. I think we should do everything we can to get off of fossil fuels as quickly as we can, including coal. But I think going from coal to natural gas and putting the investment into doing that is a really bad investment. And it distracts us from moving off of getting away from both as quickly as possible. So I spent an hour or so on the phone last week with Tom Congdon, who's the governor's top guy for energy. And he was very interested in that. I think that you can all help make that case. Yeah, we agree we should be getting off of coal, but taking a 10-year hiatus over here to natural gas, I mean, the plant up in Lansing, right? That's what we're talking about.
Right.
If we're going to convert that to natural gas, we've got to build a pipeline to it. There's a big cost associated with that. The long-term supply of the natural gas is problematic. The greenhouse gas consequences are problematic. So I personally think we should nurse that plant along in its current state until we can do something that's really better. And we should, in this county, move as aggressively as we can towards the true renewables. That's my take.
Thanks. I appreciate you saying that.
Okay, Pam, you're next.
I was just wondering what the response has been among New York government officials, elected officials, if there's been much positive response. Have you had much interest in this whole project?
Well, the governor has granted us a meeting. We will be meeting with the governor to present the plan personally to him. He made a promise to us meaning the group that have been working on this project for a couple of years, as Bob mentioned. He promised that he would not make a final decision on shale gas until he heard us out. And so at this point, we are on his calendar secretary's to-do list. We don't have a date yet, but we've been promised a personal meeting with him to give him the long version of this talk, and there will be a bunch of us there to do that.
Maybe.
You want to add anything to that?
Just that the paper came out only 6 weeks ago. That's not a very long time. I'm really very pleased by the response we've gotten, and it's it's asking a lot for people to believe this is possible, because we've all been led to believe for so long that renewables are great, but they're out there in some universe in the far future, you know. And I think actually that was true 10 years ago. It's probably true 5 years ago, but the technologies have changed, and so it is doable now. But that's a hard sell for people to accept, and I understand why that's true. But still, we can do it.
Frank, did you want to, very quickly.
Yeah, Tony, if what you said if he really promised not to make a decision on shale gas until you've had this meeting, can you delay the meeting for about three years or so?
Oh, my God.
He's been delaying the meeting. We didn't even have to ask.
Just a thought.
Yeah, good point.
Can you ask the PSC to delay their decision until after that meeting? All right. Let's see. I've got Nathan. Then Peter.
This is a fantastic presentation, and I will definitely go on the website and actually read the paper. And I wanted to ask, how could we advance this plan or a plan like this, legislatively, and how could we encourage, consumers and private sector folks to change their behavior? Now, I recall that one of the slides said it was 37% of this is what, water heating systems and electric cars and all that. Even if we don't get movement on the other front, can we have, New York State incentives for electric cars and those kind of conversions? I mean, what do you think would be a good first step, and what role does the private sector have in this?
Excellent question. And when you read the paper, and you're all going to read it, it's your assignment, you'll notice that one half of the paper is non-technical.
Yeah.
It literally is the policy dimensions.
Oh, nice. Okay, wonderful.
And there are dozens of recommendations for policy changes, policy procedures, tax changes, incentive changes.
Yeah.
We might look like a bunch of Cornell egghead professors not operating in the real world, but we do understand how the real world works.
Yeah.
You just put a bunch of numbers out there, and they don't make any sense unless they're practicable, practical, economically viable, sociologically acceptable, and, of course, politically attractive.
Yeah.
So a good deal of thought went into that major part of the paper having to deal exactly with how do we encourage both bottom-up and top-down. There's a culture change that has to occur here, right? We don't want to decrease or severely impact our style of life, our quality of life, by making this inevitable transition from fossil fuels to renewable. So it all starts with individuals.
Yeah.
You now have CFL lighting, I hope, and you're all driving more fuel-efficient cars, and a lot of you have converted to more efficient gas heat. Some of you have converted to ground source or air source heating. Some of you have electric cars already. That has to happen, but there also have to be things coming down from above, from Washington and from Albany, in terms of changes in policy, taxation, incentives, and investment.
Yeah, and now, so those recommendations, I mean, it's not even a good measure, but what percent of them are state, what are federal, and if there are any, are there any local ones?
The proposals we put in there are aimed at the state.
Excellent.
Because it's a state plan. They're not federal, it's state. We
want
to make it, quite frankly, we don't see a lot of leadership at the national level,
so
it's why we focus on the state. And we think New York is the best state to move this forward
because
of our progressive history and because of our politics.
Mm-hmm.
It's doable. As I say, we already have New York City. That's a huge, huge head start. I think there are a lot of things local could do. We didn't focus on that. I would love to have a group think about that.
Mm-hmm.
I really would. I think that's the way to go. But let me give you one concrete example. That device over there, bottom right, that's in my basement. That's my hot water heater.
Mm-hmm.
It's a high-efficiency air-to-hot water heat exchanger. It costs me about $5 a month to get all my domestic hot water using electricity. It displaces what I used to use, which was oil.
Mm-hmm.
When I bought that, which is 2 years ago, it cost me $5,000 installed. They're now down to about $2,000.
Mm-hmm.
That's still asking people a lot, but the payback period, if you have a gas heater for your hot water and you want to go to that, the payback period would be about 3 to 4 years.
Right. Wow.
That's great. Everyone should be doing it. Why isn't everyone doing it? Well, A, they don't know. If you go to the Department of Energy website, they'll still be telling you that natural gas is the best way forward.
Mm-hmm.
They're wrong. They're out of date. They're way out of date, so that's the way to go. But not everyone can afford the $2,000 to $3,000 to $4,000 to do it either. And so funding mechanisms where the money comes up front and people pay it back are an important part of that.
Yeah.
But I would like to see everyone in Tompkins County have one of those in their house within 5 years.
Yeah.
And that's eminently doable,
and
it would cut down hugely on the natural gas use in this county.
Right.
What are they called?
It's a air to water heat exchanger. That has a trade name. That's a General Electric one, and they're highly reviewed. But I love it. It's cool.
The financing of on-bill financing that's paid where through your NYSEG bill is one way to do it. But there's a limited, it's the sort of thing that it exists. The law was passed in New York State and signed last year. Nobody knows about it.
It's already happening, as Bob said. Renewables are not in the future; they're now. We don't use the word alternative energy anymore.
Mm. Right.
It's not an alternative. It's just as viable as any fossil fuel. Mm-hmm. How many of you know that there's a truly passive home on Center Street in Ithaca? A passive home.
Lauren Todd?
An off-the-grid, zero net energy consuming home on Center Street.
Oh, I think so.
Five blocks in Center Street, downtown. So this is already happening. There are people in Tompkins County who are building green. Try getting a builder, a green builder, to build a home for you in Tompkins County right now. There's a two-year waiting list. It's already happening.
I've got Peter, Will, Kathy, Carol, and me. Peter?
Somehow I think I'm missing something here.
Use the mic, Peter.
I think I'm missing something. You're talking about no fossil fuels in what time period? 100 years, 50 years, 25? What you? I've forgotten what.
25 to 30 years.
So right now, a significant amount of fossil fuel is transportation. So you're telling me that within 25 years, there will not be a single car or truck or airplane or train that's running in New York, that all of this transportation will be done by electric cars, the only alternative that I know, given the fact that today the only electric car you can buy costs $40,000, it seems...
That's my car right there, and I paid $30,000 for it.
Well, okay, the signs I've seen when I pass by say $40,000, the Chevy, okay, the Volt. You're talking about no gasoline-powered car can enter New York, that everybody in the country, if they want to drive to New York, has to have an electric car. Somehow, maybe I don't have enough imagination, but that boggles the imagination as far as I'm concerned. I can't understand. That's comment number one. And the thing you haven't talked about is you say it's cheaper, okay, but if it's cheaper, why doesn't the market take place? Is this going to happen all of a sudden by itself because people will realize they can make more money by manufacturing electric cars and stopping and all the other uses that we currently make of gas and coal and petroleum and so forth? And if it isn't cheaper, if it is cheaper, why doesn't it happen by itself? And if it isn't cheaper, how much are we going to have to pay to make this transformation, and who's going to pay for it?
Okay, those are both excellent points. I fully understand your arguments. Let me tackle the second one first. I think market forces are working. They are moving that way. I think they will eventually get us in the right way. My hot water heater there does pay for itself, but that wasn't commercially available until 3 or 4 years ago. So it's new. People aren't aware of them. As I say, if you go online, most people aren't looking for a new water heater. And if you do and you go to either NYSERDA or Department of Energy or EPA websites, they don't even mention that as a possibility. So people aren't well informed. The markets aren't quite getting there yet. That's part of the issue. So what we're talking about is finding ways to accelerate how markets can work. There certainly are for-profit people out there. There are bankers who are really excited about selling it. And you can see, I mean, you and the county have invested in solar stuff on lots of buildings, right? And lots of towns have. Those are for-profit making ventures, right? So the market forces are moving us that way. Question is, how quickly can we move? Do I honestly think that in 25 years there'll be no gasoline-powered car in New York? No, I don't really think so. What we're saying is that it's technically possible to do so and cost-effective to do so. And by setting a target and saying that, we hope to accelerate that movement as quickly as we can. Because the costs to global warming, the cost to the economy, the cost to public health are so high that I think we should do it as quickly as we possibly can. So it's a goal. It's a technically achievable goal. It's probably not a politically achievable goal. But by pointing out that it's technically possible, we can at least move in that direction more quickly than we are.
Go ahead, Tom.
So, appreciate this, the important skepticism, Peter. And again, those are the right questions to be asking. But first, the issue in the market. 40% of all new electricity generation capacity in the United States in 2012 came from renewables. That's the market responding. In January, February, and March of this year, all new electrical generation capacity in the United States came from renewables. That's the market speaking. It's already happening. As Bob said, there's a delay in our appreciation of that. And, of course, there are obvious forces in the media, in the political realm, that are trying to teach us otherwise. The second thing I want to say is there's a perception problem here. Nobody in this room blinked. Nobody in New York blinked when the oil and gas industry said, we want to poke 100,000 holes in New York by creating 10,000 pads, 500 compressor stations, 40 new processing units, and 100,000 miles of new pipeline. And in the process, we would do the equivalent of melting down the United States Navy twice to create all the casing and all the steel necessary to do that. Nobody blinked. Why not? It can do that. Market forces allow it to happen. But as soon as somebody comes along with an alternative that has the same sort of scope in terms of moving people and moving material and changing an industry, we blink because we're conditioned. We're conditioned to fossil fuels and accepting everything that fossil fuels have brought us, and conditioned to almost accepting more fossil fuel development in New York State. So there's a matter of cultural perception involved that people just have to, they all share, first person who reads the paper, every person who reads the paper, the first thing they see is, what, 12,000 wind generators? Are you kidding? Why not 100,000 shale gas wells?
Let's see, Will is next, then Kathy, Carol, me.
Thank you, Martha. Excellent presentation, and I really would encourage you to do an extended version locally, get it taped, and I think a lot of people would be happy to come. You made me depressed. I didn't know these water heaters existed. I just replaced the water heater, and now I'm stuck with a dinosaur. The number you told, if I heard it correctly, was $35 billion in terms of the cost. Was that correct?
$33 billion.
And you said that essentially it could be covered by the avoided cost of health of health care.
The $33 billion is the health care cost. Let me rephrase that.
Okay.
So 17 years, the total cost of the plan is $560 billion, I think I said. Something like that. So it's $33 billion, which is the health care cost over 17 years would be an equivalent savings.
Okay.
That's the argument we made.
Okay. And, of course, some of that health care problem is dealt with air pollution from other states. How do we deal with that issue?
I believe, and Tony can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe we factored in for New York-produced fossil fuel air pollution. That is the cost of what we produce in this state to our citizens.
And so when you meet with the governor, the issue is you're right to say that we didn't blink when they talked about the capitalization for the shale gas, because that's all private. This, presumably, a lot of it needs to be public. No? All can be done privately.
Yeah. Our plan didn't call. I mean, it calls for moving ahead with government programs of the sort that there are, but I think we...
Incentives.
Some incentives. But we trust that the major funding will come from the private sector. It pretty much has to.
Okay. Thank you.
And market forces do matter. Mm-hmm. We're just trying to accelerate them and focus them.
And once again, New York State is in the fore here because CAPEX for oil and gas originates in New York City. Every time Chesapeake wants to poke another hole in the ground in Pennsylvania, somebody has to walk into an investment bank in New York City and say, loan me $6 million. So when that investment banker is offered soon an alternative, do I put $6 million down another hole in the ground, which only produces gas for 3 or 4 years, and then I have to poke another hole in the ground, and I'm not making any money on the gas, or we hope that sooner or later they're going to see the return on the investment is moving in the right direction. We're hoping. But it's got to be mostly private investment. Our retirement plans.
Yeah. Kathy.
That was a perfect segue when you mentioned retirement plans. I've got two things that haven't been discussed that I bet y'all have heard about. It might verge on the political, but I think y'all can work around that. The Do the Math Tour with 350.org, they're urging divestment, particularly from pension plans and college pension plans. There's a group up at Cornell, I think there's a group at IC, and they're urging divestment from fossil fuels. You know, a year ago, people would have thought that was kind of crazy, but now people are sort of getting the idea that that might be a way to help drive the market forces. Right. Any policy things or just observations about that you might have? Because it's kind of exciting to me. I know that locally, our presidents of our local college, Cornell, hasn't been overtly receptive to it as yet, but give it time, right? Maybe a month? I know. I'm putting you in a spot. So do I.
I don't want to be holding again.
No.
Pressure for that.
My immediate reaction as a private citizen and a Cornell employee is that I would hope that universities across the country take very seriously the proposals to divest from continued investment of their funds in oil and gas for moral reasons. We're educating a next generation, and it's the next generation that's going to inherit an ill wind.
Well, I talked recently with my TIAA CREF advisor, and I mentioned to him, and I've also sent letters just saying that it's something I'd be interested in, but I want to see when we get a chance to vote our shares for that. And I heard that I won't say imminent, but it's a possibility in the future. And it takes little steps like that, but from our community to do that would be, you know, pretty good.
Yeah, no, I agree totally. And divestment's part of it, but investment. You know, invest in this is an alternative. The group you talk about, there's a group that's jointly between Cornell and Ithaca College, as well as a lot of the regional high schools that's been pushing that. My daughter, Marina Howarth, who's a junior in Trumansburg High School, is one of the 7 members of the core group. So it's a countywide group of students across all age groups, and I'm very proud of what they're doing.
They're doing great work. I'll get to my second part, which is about investment. As an electrician, this is just thrilling. And I can say that for 2 decades, we've been looking at the grid, the national grid, and, you know, 2 decades ago, you could say, well, it needs repairing. We know now that it needs replacing. It needs, not with the same technology. We have the capacity to do incredible things now that couldn't be done before. And when you talk about wind turbine energy and photovoltaics and solar, we've got folks that, in my union, we've got a training center being built that are being trained in all this stuff. And I know that the plumbers are doing similar things with heat exchange and you know the right terms for it. Yeah. So for us, it's really exciting. The piece that I've hit up on a few times, and we've discussed it here, is manufacturing. Because if we have to buy our turbines manufactured somewhere else in China, it doesn't seem like it's such a savings when you have to bring it all the way over here. And yet, getting the investment in the manufacturing here always lags the market. So there's a way, I guess it comes into your policy things, where I'd like to find ways to encourage manufacturing here for all these kind of things that are really would help us to be sustainable while we're managing to build with local, with local skilled trades people.
One quick reaction to the issue of the need to redo the electrical grid, not just in New York State, but across the country. I think everybody agrees that regardless of whether we quickly move to renewables or it's delayed, it's all going to be electricity. So you have a choice. You can invest capital right now in digging long holes in the ground and dropping steel in them to create pipelines. That's a grid. It's a natural gas grid. But it's only going to be useful until the natural gas is gone. And the most optimistic estimates, not including LNG exports, okay, is that we have maybe 20 years of gas. So do you want to drop all that money in those long holes in the ground? I refer to them as long, what do you put that people in the ground, what do they call them?
Graves.
You know, 10,000 miles of graves in New York State? Or do you want to take that same capital and invest it in something that we and our kids and our grandkids are obviously going to need, which is a new electrical grid? Again, a choice of investment in the infrastructure. And it's private investment that's going to determine that.
Just on the manufacturing side, our plan didn't address where this stuff would come from, and it's priced for the current market, which means coming in from China for the most part. I've subsequently been told by several people that the price of manufacturing it in New York would not be all that much higher. It'd probably increase the capital cost by about 7%. And that might well be worth considering, and that might be a place where government incentives are appropriate. If
Can
we
I
want to do
ask,
it in New York.
Is that wind turbine and photovoltaic?
Yeah.
Or, wow, no kidding.
Yeah.
That's a big change since even the last time I heard. Great news. Thanks.
GE is big in New York, and GE is big in wind.
Cool.
GE also makes that thing over there in the lower left. The GE's heavily into this, so New York has a stake.
Who installed it for you, if you don't mind me asking?
Hubbard Plumbing and Heating from Interlaken.
Okay, cool. Thank you. Thanks for what you're doing. It's awesome.
I'm up to Carol.
Yeah, thanks for taking some of your precious time away from your science and the writing and everything else that you're doing to come and speak to us. Do you know offhand the link to, there is a six or seven minute video out there of Tony, of you speaking, I think it is, with some of this presentation. Is there an easy link to that, or we would have to send that out?
On this stuff?
Is it on this stuff, or is it on...
It's related.
It's related?
The video you're referring to is, I think it's titled, The Link Between Shale Gas Development and Climate Change, which has a number of the images that you saw here buried in it. And the easy way to get to that, I can write down for you. There's a website where you can download the video or watch it online.
Okay, so if we can get that...
There's a six-minute version and there is a 16-minute version.
16, right. That would be good for us to see. And maybe somebody could distribute it to all of us. So Tompkins County now has a committee, one of our standing committees, that has the word energy in the title. And in trying to look at how do we address New York State energy policy, we just started asking the question, well, what is New York State energy policy? Is there an energy policy? Where is it written? And so I when you go talk to the governor, we haven't learned a whole lot yet, but one of the things that we've learned in the little bit we've been able to look is that New York State said, to the extent that we say we have a renewable energy policy and the NYSERDA office that we've set up, that has a certain amount of staffing and money available to give out. But when you look at where is energy practice really delivered, it seems to be through the PSC, which is, it's a public authority. It is administered. It is independent somewhat, and it has a lag time in terms of the members who are appointed to their board. And when you look at the size of the staff and the money that goes into New York State's renewable energy policy and attempts to talk about climate change and getting reining in emissions, we have a draft plan that hasn't ever actually been adopted. On the one hand, we've got a set of staff doing that. And then on the other hand, what the staff and the money we've got invested in overseeing the existing technologies, and that is less than 1% solar. If you look at the pie chart, it's less than 1% solar. It's less than 1% geothermal, it's less than 1% wind, it's about 15 or 16% hydro, and all the rest is fossil fuel and nuclear. Right. And the staff that we've got in place and the orders that they hand down about how we the private sector builds out the plants, how they upgrade them, they're not just the plants, but the transmission and distribution system is all overseen there. So we're trying to get our brains around how do we weigh into New York State and to the public and to people who've been paying attention to energy now about calling on New York State to get this hand in sync with this hand, or that hand in sync with this hand, and having a hard time doing it. So when you talk to the governor, please try not to leave out the PSC, and please give us some feedback about the reception you get and ways in which we can be most effective in making that argument.
Just one brief response, and I'll let Tony augment from a different angle, perhaps. I agree that PSC is a critical part of it, but the, you know, they're mostly in the well, they're utilities, right? So it's electricity and then the gas transmission. It's a huge amount. Our energy plan is not just about electricity. We're calling for electrification, but it's very much about home heating, commercial heating, water heating, transportation. And if you look at where natural gas is used in the country, in the world, in the state, it's a lot more of it used for heating than for anything else. And it's the low-hanging fruit, and we're not dependent on the PSC to get rid of it. We can weatherize homes. We can convert to more efficient water heaters. We can convert to ground-source heating of homes. We can do a lot of things. And I believe a lot of that could be led at the county level, regardless of what the state does.
Yeah, a lot of what you were referring to, Carol, has to do with the renewable portfolio standards for New York State. And if I could be wrong by one or two points here, but I believe it's 25% by 2015 and 30% by 2025 or something like that. And that's really, really not stretching really far. Mm-hmm. I mean, we already have 12% from hydro. So going from 12% hydro to 15% renewable wasn't a big stretch. We're already there. So we got to raise the bar, and we got to accelerate towards more aggressive renewables. And we will take that message to the governor. I'm sure he's aware of it because it has all the benefits that we talked about tonight.
Nathan, and I've got a couple things.
So the cost of all this is $570 billion or so. Now, did you do a model where you adjusted for new technology and said, you know, with technology acceleration, what would happen? And the reason why is because, like, I mean, I'm just thinking, like, with Peter, you were talking about electric cars, right? Like, I read about electric cars all the time. You know, you have like the Tesla Model S, right? The Tesla Model S goes 230 miles. It goes 0 to 60 in 5.9 seconds. It has 302 horsepower, and it costs $60,000, and it wasn't possible like 2 years ago, right? And so, and I mean, and it just came out, and it has great reviews, right? And it's as competitive as a luxury sedan, and it is a luxury sedan, right? But, you know, I was reading like 2 months ago, University of Southern California, I think, they made changes to existing lithium-ion batteries that like tripled the amount of capacity and actually made it so you could charge one of these things in 10 minutes, right? And they said that they can get that into production in 3 or 4 years. Right, so this technology acceleration is huge right now, especially when it comes to storage, which is our main, one of our big problems with renewable energy sources. So, if you had, I mean, is that something you guys have done? Accounted for this rapid increase in technology, and could it be done?
I'll let you talk about it. We're very conservative. As I say, we tried largely to stick to what's there now, because otherwise you're stuck in, across, you know, it's in the future.
Yeah.
And so we wanted to go to what's now. It's cost-effective now. Sure, it's going to get far more so as we roll along, but we don't have to wait to get started. Right. I mean, think of the huge transition that the world made when we went from horse-drawn carriages to cars, you know? I mean, we went to first cars or horse-drawn carriages with funky little engines on top of them and weird steering things. But it was only about 20 years before things started to look almost like cars, you know. Yeah. You don't wait until you have the modern car before you start making that transition. But surely there's a lot of improvement that's not included in our model. We're very deliberately conservative.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that's what's exciting is that $570 billion is your high number, basically.
Two things. That paper is already obsolete, literally, because there's another paper that's under review right now, more or less the same authors, but focused on California.
Yes.
Mark wanted to go back and talk about California. Yeah, we convinced him to do New York first. And then the process of writing the paper for California, of course, there's a two-year lag in the technologies have changed, so the numbers have been updated for California.
Yeah.
So we should redo this paper based on the things we did in California. Yeah. One other thing, I never hesitate to draw a comparison between this and shale gas. So I'm an engineering educator, have been at Cornell for 37 years. I'm not going to walk into my class and encourage my young engineering students to help invent a new green fracking fluid. I'm pointing in this way.
Yeah.
Oh, and I must say, the excitement of the students, you know, I teach the freshman ecology class at Cornell, among other things, and I gave a brief introduction to this, 10 minutes, no more than that, and I just got swarmed in a way that I've never been swarmed. It's like a rock star, you know. These freshmen want to have their pictures taken, and they said, it goes back to what I said earlier about the unions, you know. I mean, people are ready for a change. People are past due for a change. Society wants to change, and it's there, it can happen, so it's exciting.
I'm going to point out that it was a 15-minute presentation, but we've had questions. No. This is what we're here for. This really, I got to say, no better way for us to spend our time. A couple of things I want to add. I'm going to put you in touch with a fellow named Chris Wentlent from Constellation Energy, who approached us, I don't know, Ed, 2-3 years ago, with an idea about sort of really taking hold of the entire Tompkins County energy system and working with us on the public, private, and you know, they're really practical people of how to move things ahead. Solarize Tompkins is something that Danby, Dryden, and Caroline are already doing. Dan, maybe you remember, are you part of it, Dan Klein? Where it's basically getting families together to volunteers to sort of purchase photovoltaics, right, Dan? I tried to go to the meeting last week. I couldn't make it. That sort of a group purchasing of photovoltaics for homes, which just, you know, a lot of the reason people don't do this stuff is like, oh, golly, where do I start? How do I do it? It's weird. It's different. So it's almost like a buy-in club. You just, you know, everybody signs up. You negotiate that there's a contract. You get a volume discount. So these three towns are working on this right now. I have a question for you guys and then a question for Ed. Why the issue that shale gas is more damaging than coal is such a critical question, and most environmental groups cheer up and down. Yeah. Even the Union of Concerned Scientists, I get the newsletter. They're just thrilled when every coal plant closes. And they don't talk about the fact that those plants are closing and being replaced by gas. And it is a really hard thing to swallow that everybody's conventional idea that gas is cleaner is wrong. I mean, we understand that the reason for the cognitive dissonance that when you have the unit of gas and the unit of coal, the combustion is less damaging for gas, but you have to look at the entire life cycle. So, what do you see as the progress? How can we get the rest of the environmental? Oh, this is like a small question for you guys. How can we get the rest of the environmental movement to understand, I mean, where's that debate going?
Well, let me take a start at that. I mean, Tony and I published the very first peer-reviewed paper ever on what the greenhouse gas footprint of shale gas was, and that was only 25 months ago. That's not that long in terms of the political realm, the science realm, or anything else. I think we've gotten incredible buy-in in our research and in our idea considering that. The Sierra Club still isn't perfect, but they've come an awful long way from where they were 2 to 3 years ago. NRDC has come a long way from where they were a couple of years ago. Union of Concerned Scientists has further to go, but they're talking to Tony and to me and to others. They're having internal debates. So, you know, I think many of the big environmental groups are going that way. The broader scientific community is much more engaged than it was. There's a huge amount of effort to quantify what the methane emissions were. Our paper did a crude analysis. We did the best job we could with crude data, but what we said was it needed to be done much better because it's important, and people have taken up that challenge, and there's a one peer review paper already showing that we were way too conservative. It's worse than we said. There are actually two already. There are many more in the works. I think most of them are going that way. So within 3 to 4 years, I think there'll be a pretty strong science consensus on that. I'll be very surprised if that's not the case. The time frame is critical, as we talked about, this global warming potential idea. That plot I showed you quickly by Drew Shindell of the NASA Goddard Space Institute, that only came out last year. And he's been working with us and communicating with us as well. We helped drive him to think about how to frame that. He knew that. That's what his models are showing. But he wasn't focusing on the importance of methane shorter term. So the science is undergoing a radical transformation. It's moving very quickly. Our initial work was extraordinarily conservative, and I think it's holding up very well. So I'll be very, very surprised if there isn't a strong scientific consensus within 5 years. Supporting more or less what we said, with a lot firmer detail behind it. The policy world lags that somewhat, but we're moving there, and that's astronomically fast for science.
Yeah, and you'll make sure the governor hears that.
I want to pick up on the point you made about coal plants being converted to natural gas. Actually, not so much. By now you know I'm a numbers wonk. And I pointed out the percentage of new electricity generation that's actually coming from renewables. So you probably heard that in the last 4 years, carbon dioxide emissions in the U.S. actually decreased by 8 or 9%. And the press and the government said, oh, that's because we transform our coal-fired power plants to natural gas. Actually, no. The vast majority of that decrease in carbon dioxide emissions came because we slowed down industry in the last 4 years. Did you notice? And about half of that was because of the increase in renewables. And most recently, in the last few months, many coal-fired power plants that which were going to shift to natural gas have decided not to shift to natural gas because natural gas prices have gone up from $2 a thousand to $4 a thousand. And with the upcoming presidential decision to allow export of liquefied natural gas prices are going to go up again, and coal-fired power plants are again going to be affordable. This is all going in the wrong direction because we're dilly-dallying around with one fossil fuel versus another fossil fuel, and you know who makes money there, instead of doing what we've been talking about tonight, which is forget about fossil fuels and let's hurry up and move on to renewables. So there's a lot of misinformation, disinformation, and incorrect interpretation of data going on.
Okay. Yeah. And the question to Ed is, the cleaner, greener Southern Tier plan, which really just released or it's in draft or almost draft or almost final
almost
plan.
Final part of
it. Almost final. And it's there are many, many action steps and analysis about, you know, what can be done at different levels. Could you talk a little bit about how that relates to what Tony and Bob have been talking about?
Well, you know, the Southern Tier isn't exactly the easiest place to talk about some of these things right now. But the plan, the Southern Tier Cleaner Greener plan, does show actions that could be taken regionally that could reduce emissions by 32% in 20 years by local action. So that's kind of almost... Some of that would overlap with what you're talking about because it includes some wind and other things. But largely, those are things beyond some of the things you're talking about that would be going into the grid. So there is opportunity to even lower the number that has to be supplied to the grid, potentially through actions that can be taken locally. A lot of it has to do with energy efficiency and a number of other things. But it's worth taking a look at. That's kind of the ground-up part of the equation.
You said 32% cut in how long?
I believe that was 20 by 20, 30, 35, something like that.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Ed. Anyone else? Thank you very much.
Thank
this
you.
Has really
yeah,
been
thank
an
you.
Education.
That was fantastic.
Thank you. Sorry to have run over. But,
no, no. Carol?
I just wonder if whether we or anybody we know could play a role in making sure that this presentation, in the longer version, that whether a longer version of this presentation could get to the community, whether it's appropriate for us to play a role or...
We have the ability... Jim Blizzard in the back there, the tech, has the ability to... tag our videos on the website. In fact, he does that. Where, you know, if you want to go directly to the Peak Committee report, you can go. Am I right, Kathy? I mean, you can go
to the legislature meeting.
On the legislature meeting. So you can go. So, Jim, you're listening to us. He can tag the beginning of their presentation, and then so it'll be there. It's already done. So it's a, you know, about an hour presentation, and it's not exactly the same as they might do at the Unitarian Church for the public, but I think that would, you know, for starters, that's going to be right there. Pam?
But I think that what Carol's talking about is doing the long version of this. And if it was done at the public library, we could tape that, right? We have the ability to tape that. And then that would be on our website. I mean, so I just think that it's incredibly important that we get this information out there, and that if we could help set up that meeting somehow, or working through some other group to set something up, would be, I think, a really great thing if we could manage to do that.
Tony in particular, as you know, loves to give talks, and he's great. And I also love to get this information out. So we'd welcome help to get the message out for sure. Appreciate the interest.
All right, thank you both so much. Really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Okay. All right, let's see. Where are we? I'm going to move a couple things around. Ed, you might want to go. All right, you'll be back. All right, then let's do something on behalf of Greg Potter. Can we switch to the Budget Committee report and look at Resolution E? I believe that is what is keeping Greg here.
Yep.
And then we're going to go to the Planning Committee resolutions, and then we'll go back to our agenda. So, Nathan, Vice Chair, Budget.
Martha, do we have to take a break at 7:30?
That's not to be exactly 7:30. Okay. If we could do the Resolution E.
Yeah, sure. Yeah,
Greg, that's the one you're waiting for?
Okay. Right. Okay, well, the Budget and Capital Committee met before the legislature meeting and passed Resolution E, and that resolution is Resolution E, authorizing the issuance of up to $470,000 serial bonds and notes of the County of Tompkins, New York, to pay a portion of the cost of a voice-over-internet protocol telephone system. And I so move.
Seconded by Leslin. And is that?
Yes, I believe we talked about the revised version.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
That's correct.
That is in your packet. The revised is adopted by committee, and Leslin seconds. Mm-hmm. All right. Are there any questions? For your information, F and G are similar resolutions, and the formatting changes that are part of this revision here will apply to F and G. Kathy didn't want to copy that many more pages of paper, speaking of sustainability. So any questions at all about the E? All right, we need a long form roll call, and we need 10 votes.
Mr. Stein?
Aye.
Mr. Burbank?
Yes.
Ms. Chalk?
Yes.
Ms. Herrera?
Yes.
Ms. Kiefer?
She stepped out.
Mr. Lane?
Yes.
Ms. McAsey?
Yes.
Mrs. McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
Mr. McKenna?
Yes.
Mr. Proto?
Yes.
Ms. Pryor?
Yes.
Mr. Robinson?
Yes.
Mr. Shinagawa?
Aye.
Ms. Robertson?
Yes.
Ms. Kiefer?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
That's unanimous. I guess we should have done that first, Craig. All right. Thank you very much. Maybe G and F and G will go that quickly. You want to take a shot at it, Nate?
Can I move both of them at the same time?
No. Let's.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, they are related to each other. They had to be separated due to the life of the capital, the life of the assets. But first is Resolution F. Do I have to read the entire thing? Yes. All right.
Read the title.
Authorizing the issuance of up to $4,350,000 serial bonds and notes of the County of Tompkins, New York, to pay a portion of the cost of road and highway system reconstruction and improvements at various locations throughout the county. And that also was passed by the committee, so I so move.
Second by Brian. Any questions?
I have a question.
Carol.
Yes. Do we have a list of specific roads and highways, or is this meant to be used over the next few years? For
this is a cash flow financing. It's for Henshaw, Henshaw Road, Waterberg Road, Seneca Bridge, Pine Tree, those four projects, which are all are taking place this summer. It takes quite a long time for the state to reimburse us, so this represents about 75% of the federal and state aid that we have to put out.
Thank you.
All right, ready to vote on F? All in favor? Roll call.
Mr. Stein?
Yes.
Mr. Burbank?
Yes.
Ms. Chalk?
Yes.
Ms. Ferreira?
Yes.
Ms. Kiefer?
Yes.
Mr. Lane?
Yes.
Ms. McAsey?
Yes.
Mrs. McBean-Claiborne?
Yes.
Mr. McKenna?
Yes.
Mr. Proto?
Yes.
Ms. Pryor?
Yes.
Mr. Robinson?
Yes.
Mr. Shinagawa?
Yes.
Ms. Robertson?
Yes.
14 ayes, 0 noes.
That's unanimous.
Okay, next I have Resolution G, authorizing the issuance of up to $1,650,000 of serial bonds and notes of the County of Tompkins, New York, to pay a portion of the cost of repairing and or replacing certain existing bridges located within the county. And I so move.
Second by Kathy. Any discussion? Roll call.
Mr. Stein?
Aye.
Mr. Burbank?
Yes.
Ms. Chalk?
Yes.
Ms. Herrera?
Yes.
Ms. Kiefer?
Yes.
Mr. Lane?
Yes.
Ms. McAsey?
Yes.
Mrs. McBean-Claiborne?
Yes.
Mr. McKenna?
Yes.
Mr. Proto?
Yes.
Ms. Pryor?
Yes.
Mr. Robinson?
Yes.
Mr. Shinagawa?
Yes.
Ms. Robertson?
Yes.
14 members. 14 ayes, 0 present, 0 no.
That's unanimous. All right, we're on a roll. Let's see if we can do Resolution K, because Paul is waiting for that one. Wherever she went, Paul is on here.
All right. Resolution K, deletion of administrative policy 0203, required physical.
That is packet page, I guess.
42.
Kathy Luce, seconds it by Kathy. Any discussion? This is just a regular vote,
yes,
right?
Yes.
All in favor of Resolution K, please raise your hand.
Aye.
Any opposed? That's unanimous.
Could
all right.
Why it went before the budget committee?
Yeah.
Personnel.
Oh, personnel.
Budget,
program,
capital, and personnel. Okay. All right. Ed, you have too much business for us to do. I think we have to have a break, and then we'll come back to planning resolutions. Okay? All right, I'd like to take a 10-minute break. If you can please be back in your seats at 20 up. Thank you.